The following teaching is part one of a 33-part study of the Book of Colossians by Dr. Ken Boa.
Colossians, one of the four so-called prison epistles, because Paul wrote them most likely in Rome, though some suggest Caesarea, during his imprisonment from year 60 to 61 A.D., and during this time, then, Paul had already gone through and completed his three missionary journeys. And you recall at the end of the third missionary journey, he told the Romans that it was his expectation to go to Rome. And his desire was to go to Rome and then establish Rome as his new base of operations for the rest of his ministry, just as he had used Syria and Antioch for his base of operations for his first three missionary journeys. So each of those three missionary journeys went off from the church in Syrian Antioch. So his desire, he says to the Romans, is that I can now come to you and establish you and your faith and bear fruit with you, and that we can encourage each other, but also that I would use Rome now as my new point of operations, because it's my call as an apostle, he says, to go and bring the gospel where no one had ever heard it before. That's what an apostle does, in effect. He kind of blazes new trails. And once that's been established, then he moves on to a new territory, a new region, having established leadership and so forth. It's not a hit and run. But rather, once he's got people who are beginning to carry the ball, then he moves from there. And then those people, then he keeps in touch with, he corresponds with them. Part of these epistles are about that. Why did he want to go to Rome? Because he wanted to go to the uttermost west. His desire was to go as far as Spain, which was the westernmost province of the Roman Empire. And my own view is that he probably did. Clement of Rome, writing in around the year 95, actually says that Paul went to the uttermost west. And if you're writing in Rome, that would be the direction he would have gone. So I think it's very likely he did. Because what happened after his first imprisonment is that he was released for a season. Although the book of Acts stops right very abruptly while Paul is in his own rented quarters, he's under house arrest for 2 years. Right at the end of the book of Acts, Luke stops his account and doesn't give us an indication of what would be the outcome of his trial. But clearly, Paul was released. There's much evidence to support this, besides which his so-called three pastoral epistles, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus, indicate opportunities and places he went to that are not described in the book of Acts. So as I put the pieces together, it appears that he had a season of a few years where he could go on yet a fourth missionary journey, which, as I say, may have encompassed as far as Spain in carrying this gospel. But then he was thrown in prison again, and this time it was the last time. So his second Roman imprisonment, what he wrote to Timothy, which was his last recorded letter, 2 Timothy, is that he does not expect this time to be released. Whereas if you look in Philippians chapter 1, see what his attitude is in the first imprisonment, he's wrestling with whether he ought to live or die. Because what he says is this: he knows that the prayers will turn out for his deliverance according to his earnest expectation and hope, for Philippians 1:20, that I will not be put to shame in anything, but that with all boldness, Christ will even now as always be exalted in my body, whether by life or by death. So at that juncture, he's saying it could go either way. For to me to live is Christ and to die is gain, which of course right there is one of the most rich little verses in the New Testament. To me to live is Christ and to die is gain is in fact the mindset of a person who is a spiritual conqueror. Because you see, if you die, it's gain. And if you live, it's Christ. And you can't lose with that. So to be martyred is gain. So he understood that. Now you find him wrestling whether I should stay on, whether God has more purpose and time for me or not. And it's the same thing we discussed with Jim. Does God have another phase in your life? Is he, in fact, preparing you for that new phase in your life and giving you layering and depth? You cannot minister, as you know, out of your own skill set only. It won't lead to much. You got to minister out of brokenness. You have to minister out of humility, because when we are weak, then he is strong. And Paul understood this. So he understood that out of that brokenness and out of that pain, that something new would come. My own view with Jim is that he will go into remission, and this will be a new dimension and facet of his life. But we all believe that, even as Paul says, that's God's concern. So he goes to say, if I'm to live on in the flesh, this will mean fruitful labor for me, and I do not know which to choose. But I am hard-pressed from both directions, having the desire to depart and be with Christ, for that is very much better. I'm not sure if most believers I know can make that affirmation. You ever think about that? Having the desire to depart and be with Christ, which that's much better. Usually when we think about that idea, we think about what we're leaving behind, don't we? We think about, gee, I'm not ready yet, that sort of a thing. But this was something that he aspired for, and he recognized this was true. Again, in my chat with Jim, at first he was wrestling, what's going to happen to the business? What about my family? How are we going to make it? And then God gave him a kind of peace and said, that's all going to be taken care of. And he stopped wrestling with that. Not that he was being lackadaisical. It's just that he was in a position where God now had him on his back. And therefore, it was necessary for him to trust radically and deeply in him. But he says, so I have this desire to be with Christ, yet to remain on, he says, in the flesh is more necessary for your sake. Speaking of the Philippians, convinced of this, I know that I will remain and continue with you all for your proud progress and joy in the faith. So he goes on to say that he's going to come to them again. He says the same thing to Philemon, another of the prison epistles, where he actually tells them to prepare a lodging for him. That's the confidence he has. So Galatians and Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, and Philemon, these are the prison epistles, and they all have some similar motifs. If I turned to 2 Timothy, however, you'll hear a very, very different description. In 2 Timothy 4, you don't have that expectation. Here is Paul's realization that this is going to be the last time he has an opportunity to minister in this earth. So in 2 Timothy 4, he tells Timothy that I am already being poured out, verse 6, as a drink offering, and the time of my departure has come. I wonder about that. Sometimes I think God gives a person specific grace when the time is there. I've known many people where that's true. They know they're not ready yet. There are several times when I almost got killed. I ought to do a whole talk on that, about so many times. Really, I'm talking about serious stuff. And I should have not have made it. And each of those times I realized, no, I'm not ready yet. There's something more to be done. That was the first impression. You know, the old idea, you'll relive your life and all that. There's something strange about your whole life really being seen at arm's length and as a unit. And I recognized there was some unfinished business. And God would then somehow, in some case, I don't know how he did it, pulled me out of that situation. But in this case, he knows now. He's been given the grace, and there is a kind of dying grace for him to know that this time had come. And so he said, I have fought the good fight, I have finished the course, I have kept the faith. I note, by the way, that this is an increasing topic of interest in our time. The last few years, finishing well is a very big topic that I think men are struggling with. Men want to finish well, and often we are in the journey, and we realize that we can easily get distracted, entangled, double-minded, and not finish well, because it's sad to realize that there are many people who start well and finish badly. And you do not want to be one of those people. And then we ask the question, what does it take for us to finish well? And that's a whole theme of my concluding chapter in Conformed to His Image. In fact, we've just created a visual presentation. I'll have to show it to you sometime. That reminds me of a book that I have called Voices from the Edge of Eternity. And it is a compilation. These are not near-death experiences here. This was a compilation of actual deathbed statements by Christians and non-Christians. I couldn't tell you the difference. I mean, it was, you know, the near-death deals, oh, I saw this white light and all this, and there was a great sense of peace. No, this is the real deal here. This is when they really were going to die, and the difference couldn't be more obvious. It was heaven or hell. And Wesley was a man who saw that he was ready, that he had been given that calling. Sometimes a man just knows, and you look back and you realize, you know, this is a big deal. I was with and this is relevant to this, because we talked about how Sam's terminal brain cancer, it's a form that cannot be operated on. And I saw him last week. And Sam was wrestling with this whole issue, had wrestled with it, but I could see the man had really come down to an understanding of where he was to be. Here's a guy who knows it's going to happen. It was interesting because people sometimes would come and say, no, you have to have your 70 years, you know. A man can accomplish his purposes in 7 years, in 17, in 37, in 70. Only God knows how much time you need on the planet to accomplish his purpose. When we say, gosh, he died at 17, what a tragedy. What if God accomplished his purpose for that person in 17 years? What if it takes another person 77 years to fulfill God's purpose? Understand, the difference between 17 and 77 is nothing in compared to eternity. You understand that concept is very, very important. Let's back off and get the real perspective. It's nothing. Therefore, the idea here is that we want to use the remaining years, and I think the more you grasp this, the more precious every day becomes. That's why he said, seize the day. The more precious the day becomes, because you see every day then is being given to you as a gift. And again, as Henry just pointed out, gratitude has a very short shelf life. It really does. So Paul goes on to say, in the future there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing. So it is a good thing for us then to love his appearing. That is to say, to desire, even so, come quickly, Lord Jesus. And it's again, it's not the old phrase, well, he's so heavenly minded, he's no earthly good. Or pie in the sky, by and by. You've all heard those phrases and all that. The fact is that my conviction is the more heavenly minded you become, the more you treasure the opportunities of the day, knowing that they will not be given to you again, and that what you do in this earth will in fact shape the contours of eternity. And so that it is not a trivial matter at all to invest or squander each day. You will squander the time or you'll invest it, depending on what you do, but you'll not get this day again. So it would be prudent for you to realize that God always has some particular purpose for each day. And if we're not careful, get so consumed in our activities and the illusion of control that we will miss out on the still small voice of the Spirit, miss out on what I call those kairos moments. Remember, we distinguish between chronos and kairos, chronological time. Chronos is what you put in your PDA or your planner. But kairos, opportunity time, you cannot plan. That is something that God himself creates, and you don't know when it'll be. But undoubtedly, those times in the course of a day, which you cannot plan, will be the most important moments of your day. You just cannot determine what they'll be, but God knows what they are. I think he gives everybody at least one chronos moment every day. It's kind of my suspicion. And how many of them have we missed? You look back and say, oh, that might have been it. Well, I missed that. You know, you don't beat yourself up. You just try to be more discerning next time and try to catch that moment. That's what this looks like. You see where I'm going? And as I've said also, those kairos moments often appear to be interruptions. They often appear to be a nuisance. And the reality is, though, they may well be invitations to serve Christ as he is mediated through the presence of the one you see. So that is an orientation that I think Paul was really pursuing. So the contrast then between these epistles and the end was great. Paul had some more time to go on. Now, in Colossae was a minor city about 100 miles east of Ephesus, and it was in the region of the seven churches of Revelation 1 to 3. Remember those seven churches described in Revelation 1 to 3? Philadelphia, Thyatira, Smyrna, Sardis, Laodicea, Pergamum. All these churches were mentioned, and each one of them had their own particular strengths and weaknesses. And Colossae, while not included in them, actually had become, by this time, a smaller town. Laodicea and Hierapolis kind of took over. And the interesting thing here is, if it weren't for this epistle, you never would have heard of Colossae. It had no impact in ancient church history. The town was getting smaller. And I don't know, it's really bizarre. When you go to the archaeological remains of places like Philippi, places that had a vibrant, and now they're, well, all they are is just a bunch of rubble. It's really strange to realize that God does a thing, but it's not, he does it through people, but his spirit comes, his spirit goes, and so forth. It's not the institution that God is concerned about. He's never, by the way, committed himself to institutions. We are, but he isn't. His commitment is to people, not institutions. I parenthetically mention this because what's the greatest institution of the Old Testament? So much written about it. The greatest institution of the Old Testament. Something you think would be a good thing to pursue. The law of the Ten, but those aren't institutions. Those were laws, and sacrifices were, you know, aspects of the law. I'm thinking of the temple. I'm thinking about Solomon's temple. That was no minor deal. And if you read 1st and 2nd Chronicles, it gives us a priestly view, and it's all centered around the temple and its worship and so forth. Very big deal. And all of Israel's identity was illustrated in that temple. And you would have thought, well, God's the one who gave him the pattern for the temple. Remember that? He actually revealed the pattern, what was to be like, and it had to be done just this way. Wouldn't you think, therefore, that he'd be pretty committed to that institution? Remember the day of dedication when Solomon is actually having completed the temple, and the very day it's dedicated, and the Spirit of God, the Shekinah, goes into the most holy place, and it's so powerful that the priests can't even go into the building. And so it's obvious God is with this. And Solomon offers this beautiful prayer, one of the richest in the Old Testament, about its dedication and so forth. But then God tells him, this is a good thing that you have done. But he says, if you people are unfaithful, I'll tear this place down. I'll turn it into a byword, a place for men to hiss and to say, what has become of this? I have no commitment to your institution. If you choose to disobey me, I'll tear that thing down. I parenthetically point out that God also, the same is true of denominations. They come, they go. And very rarely do I hear a denomination last. There comes a point when in a denomination's life, it has its birth, growth, decay, and death. And death begins to occur when people begin to play fast and loose with the world system and buy into the cultural agenda and then try to impose that on the church. When that occurs, it's almost impossible for the group to really be renewed. This is the thing. I find that very few institutions remain faithful after 200 years. That's just been my observation. Just as I know of no revival that's lasted more than one generation. Tremendous revival, and then the next generation, it's gone. Isn't that intriguing? Notice how ephemeral and how fragile these things are. God's concern isn't with the things we do. Our focus is on building this institution, whatever it might be. And one of those institutions may be your own work. It may be your own livelihood. God says, look, I'm happy that if you want to do these actions, but if you're not doing it for my name, I couldn't give a rip. And frankly, I'm not going to care about what the outcome will be. At the end, this will all just be gone. And if Christ were to tarry, everything we see will be gone. This building and everything we see in it will be gone if he were to tarry. And I happily believe that it won't be long before he comes, but that's another story. But my thinking here is that look at the civilizations. Go to Laodicea. Go to Ephesus. Go to Colossae. Go to Rome. All that was great, all that was powerful, has now become something that is great only in its literature and distant, distant memory. That ought to tell us something, shouldn't it? Shouldn't it tell us then to treasure the one thing that God declares to be truly important, and that's people? Because we, being created in his image, are such that when all these institutions are gone, we'll still be around. That their age, as Lewis put it, is like, compared to ours, like the age of a gnat. They will be gone, but we will be here. It's funny because you have these two orientations. On the one hand, relative to the world, we come and we go, and the cultures and so forth stay for a while. But actually, from a biblical top-down perspective, it's the cultures and civilizations that come and go, and we, being eternal beings, will be here in the new creation. We still will exist. So understanding that, then, you want to hold a loose enough grip to the things that often consume you. And that's really a major theme in this book, the preeminence of Christ. If I had to give you one summary of the theme of Colossians, it's the preeminence of Christ in all things. And if I do not make him preeminent in my business, if I don't make him preeminent in my family, if I don't make him preeminent in my thought life, then I'm going to be missing the purpose and calling in those areas of my life and others. Without the preeminence of Christ in these areas of your life, you will not really be able to fulfill the mission God's called you to accomplish. That's just how I see it. So that it is the preeminence of Christ and the presence and person of Christ that's meant to animate your decisions day by day. That's why I tell people, do not commit the folly of making a decision that is even moderately important. In other words, something that really gets your attention and you wrestle over it. Don't ever do that without inviting Christ in the process. That is a foolish thing for you to do. It's the dumbest thing a Christian businessman can do is to make a decision in his business without asking Christ's counsel and without pursuing him. Do you see where I'm going with that? Why has that got to be a separate arena? It should not never be. So that if the decision is important enough to really grasp your attention and grip you, it's something you better be praying about. And I always tell people, if you can possibly defer the decision until you have his peace, do so. There'll be some times when you cannot defer it, and then you have to go by your best lights and pray about it and offer the results in God's hands. But there are going to be some situations where if you can defer it, and as you wait upon the Lord, that would be better to do. You know I'm a big believer in business to the glory of God. You glorify God when you do your business well. But it's not your business that's all fired important. It's what it's designed to accomplish in the kingdom. So don't take the visible and make it so important that you miss out on the purpose of the visible, namely, the transcend the invisible, that which will endure. So having said all that then, what we look at is a book that focuses on the person of Christ. This is the most Christ-centered book in all the Bible. Because Paul stresses the preeminence of Christ and the completeness of the salvation that Christ provides. He's going to emphasize that Christ and nothing else is sufficient. He's all you need for life and for godliness and for power. And he's going to be combating a growing heresy that's occurring in Colossae. And I see a growing heresy that's similar in our own time. He was dealing with a kind of a proto-Gnosticism. It was an early form of Gnosticism. And Christian Gnosticism was the idea that only those who have the real gnosis, they're in the know. The gnosis is a Greek word for knowledge. And only those people who really had the inside scoop could really be where they needed to be. And that, by the way, is a growing, abounding thing. The religion of Elaine Pagels or Dan Brown, those kinds of things, Da Vinci Code, we're moving very rapidly into more and more Gnosticism, where Jesus is thrown in among many other things as something. But it's not Gnosticism. The Gnostic Christ is to redefine him into a Christ that is not unique and distinctive. They deny that Jesus is the Christ, and they say all of us have the Christ in us. And it becomes a very, very interesting twist, an old twist on New Age thought. And this is the sort of the thing that Paul is going to combat in this epistle. Here's how he combats it. He's going to say, the way you defeat or refute what's going on in this world is by focusing on Christ and looking at the real thing. Because if you focus your attention on who he is and elevate who he is in your mind, then you have the perspective to discern what's going on around you. And I know you've heard that the way people learn how in banks how to tell counterfeit money is by studying the real thing, not by looking at the counterfeits. You want to know the counterfeit, you study the real thing. Frankly, there are so many ways, new ways, a person can counterfeit. You can't study them all. The best thing you can do is to learn the real thing so well that intuitively you discern that something is wrong with this, you see. I've had books given to me, and I didn't know about the book, and so somebody made it, they were all gushing and effusive. You need to read this book. And usually it's when the first chapter, all of a sudden you say, oh no, I see where this is going. And I remember one, it was, what was it, Embraced by the Light, Robert? I can't remember. It was, yeah, one of your favorites. There was a book, someone who was raving about it. Christian who told me about it should have had more discernment. This book, at the first chapter, it was okay, you know. I just had a little bit of, but then they started to get into where they were going. And I realized, oh no, this is another crazy Gnostic thing. But what turned it out to be was a fabulously interesting combination of Mormonism and New Age. This woman was a New Age Mormon. Just very unusual combination before.
What an accomplishment.
But my point is only this, that people who read that book ought to know better. Here's the reason why people are seduced into these nutty books like the Da Vinci Code. I've heard people more than once say, you know, I always thought it was that way, but now I know. It's a shoddy novel. In fact, I got to tell you, when I do my Unraveling the Da Vinci Code, I show how third-rate the scholarship is. You can't get anything right, either related to any of Leonardo's paintings, anything related to the Louvre. Everything he says is practically wrong. You know, at least on a monkey would get a 50% average on a true-false test. You know, you could throw a dart and get 50% if it's true-false. Would you agree with that? I mean, frankly, it's hard. It's just as hard to get a zero in a true-false test as it is to get 100. But I think at least when he's claiming that all the locations, the artwork and all that is accurate, and he claims this on his website, shouldn't at least be, when you go there and check it out and look at the paintings, at least, oh, that's true, then the other's true. You see what I'm trying to say? Usually you want to clothe the error in truth. Well, I'm not clear why he would distort the Louvre. He might as well have said that Victoria Falls was next to the Louvre. You know, I mean, you know, at that point, where are you going with this? For example, the pyramid on the bottom, he says, is 3 feet high, and then the inverted pyramid is 6 feet above the floor. What would that mean from the distance from the one to the other? You figure it out. 3 feet, right? You go there, and it's 4 inches. That ain't hard to get right. You know what I'm trying to say? But I have been there. I have a photograph of it. But the point is only this, that people are more gullible in our time than ever before. Understand, in the past, we lived in a time when people in our culture understood the Bible much better than they do. We are biblically illiterate in our culture. Think about the great writers, Herman Melville, Jane Austen, George Eliot, Charles Dickens, then, of course, Russians like Dostoevsky and Turgenev and Tolstoy. What do they all have in common in their writings? In every case, they assumed a profound biblical knowledge, otherwise their work was meaningless. Let me give you the best example. What's the first sentence in Melville's Moby Dick?
Call me Ishmael.
Now, if you do not know that name, you miss the point of the novel. The first novel, the first sentence tells you the whole novel. Who was Ishmael? He was the son of the slave of Hagar, and therefore illegitimate, and therefore not the line through which the real line would be. Namely, it was Isaac, the son of the promise. Immediately, this guy says, I'm Ishmael, that I have been rejected, and there's a bitterness just to say, call me. You catch the point here? And that, without a knowledge, if that novel had been produced today, how many people would know what that sentence meant? And I'd say precious few, precious few. The same is true of art. You go to a museum and you see the artwork. Few people today could grasp what those paintings were about. Yet they are all filled with biblical imagery for a reason, because the people assumed they understood that. The less people know, the more gullible they are. Well, we'll stop there, but the bottom line is this. Christ is preeminent, and there are going to be a lot of false Christs in the world. And so to know the real thing is the key to avoiding the false things and not being gullible, tossed about by every wave, wind of doctrine. But growing up into maturity, we become people who grow into the maturity of Christ. And we do that by being well embedded in the timeless truths of God's Word.
This concludes Dr. Ken Boa's teaching. For more information about Reflections Ministries, please visit us on the web at www.reflectionsministries.org.